Testing, 1, 2,
This is 2004, and I'm with Jay Siegel, and this is part of the MSU Sesquicentennial Oral History Project and Ralph Turner Oral History Project. And Jay, you can see we're going to tape record this. Do we have your permission to do so?
Yes, you do.
Okay, well, thank you. Jay, I'd like to start with some background for your own, where you grew up and so forth. So if you could just, where did you grow up?
Washington, D.C. I'm a native of the nation's capital. And I was there for my first 29 years. Went to school there, including George Washington University, from which I have 3 degrees, including a Ph.D. in chemistry.
Where did you go to undergrad or your high school?
That was in Maryland, in the Washington, D.C. suburbs in Silver Spring, Maryland. I was in the first graduating class of Springbrook High School out there.
And after you completed your degrees at George Washington.
Yes.
George Washington. Where did you go from there?
Well, actually, I got a job in a crime laboratory when I was all but dissertation, ABD, and I was looking for a job. And I had a research grant from the NSF, and it ran out, and I was just about done, and I was looking for a job. And my PhD advisor put me onto this crime laboratory run by the state of Virginia, not far from where I was living. And I went out there and had an interview for a job. I knew nothing about forensic science at the time. This was even before Quincy was on TV, so it was a long time ago, on the order of 1974. And I got a job at the crime laboratory analyzing controlled substances, and then I moved on to trace evidence and got bit by the forensic science bug. I really loved the work. I loved the court testimony and the analysis and the crime scenes and all of that. And I stayed there for 3 years. And when I left, I was doing trace evidence mostly. And then I had gone out to Denver for a job interview at another crime lab. My wife and I were interested in relocating away from Washington. I'd been there my whole life, and it was time to look at something else. And she had family in Denver. So I went out and interviewed at the Colorado Bureau of Investigation for a job, and it went very well. They interviewed 9 people, and they could offer the job to the top 3, and I finished second. And I remember the interview was like one of these 2-hour panel interviews, and when I finished, they asked me if I wanted a tour of the lab, and I said yes. And I went outside to take this tour, and one of the people who interviewed me for the job chased me out in the hall, and he said, "Look, I don't care if you get this job or not," he said, "but I've got a teaching position open in Metropolitan State College, which is in downtown here," and he said, "You have a PhD and you have experience and you're just what we're looking for. Would you go talk to the guy who's sort of caretaking it today?" So I said, "Sure." So I met with the fellow who was running the program then, Jack Cummins, and ultimately what happened with the job at the Colorado Bureau of Investigation is they offered it to this guy and then he flunked the polygraph. So he couldn't take it. And they offered it to a woman, and back then there were very few women in forensic science. And she apparently took the job and had a very hard time there with the chauvinism and stuff and quit. Meanwhile, I got the job teaching forensic science and analytical chemistry at Metropolitan State College. I always wanted to get into college teaching. That had been my passion. And so I snapped that job right up. They had a program there with almost nobody in it. And it had just gotten started, and the guy who was doing it didn't know what he was doing, and so they got rid of him. And one of the chemistry profs was caretaking it. So they hired me on, and I built the program from nothing and really enjoyed that. I ultimately got offered the job at the Colorado Bureau of Investigation and, of course, turned it down. Then they had to re-advertise it, and I ended up sitting on the board to interview people for it. So full circle.
Full circle.
But I enjoyed Metropolitan State College immensely, and I was having a really good time, and then I was thumbing through chemical and engineering news one day, and I saw the opening here for the forensic science program that Ralph Turner was retiring. And my wife is a Spartan, so, and her family was all around us. They were in Detroit, they were in Grand Rapids. And so we decided to take a flyer, and I came out here and interviewed, and that's where I met Ralph. And Ralph and I hit it off right away. I have fond memories of being in the Kellogg Center, and that's where they put me up.
Yeah.
Ralph picks me up at the airport at about, I don't know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, and we grabbed some dinner, and then we went back to the room, and I thought, well, I'll get some sleep here. He was in my room until 2 a.m., just giving me his war stories from the very start and telling me about the university and about himself. And I will never forget that one, that night. It was just fascinating listening to him. He was a legend anyway, and then just to sit and rap with him for hours.
Yeah.
It was the beginning of a great adventure, actually.
How long were you at Metropolitan?
3 years.
3 years.
Yep. And I've been Michigan State for 24.
Had you been involved in the American Academy for Forensic Science prior to coming to Michigan State?
Yeah, I joined actually when I was in Denver. So it's just about 30 years now for me in the Academy. I don't remember going to meetings then. We had no travel budget back then. And so I don't remember going to meetings. I started going to meetings regularly when I got here at Michigan State. But I did join the Academy, and I've been a member since about 75.
Had you heard of Ralph before you came to Michigan State or knew about the job?
Yeah, actually I had, just from contacts and from being involved in the Academy and the like. I had heard of Ralph. At that time, I mean, the only really decent forensic science program in the country was here. I mean, when you talked about forensic science, it was Michigan State. The one at Chicago didn't exist then. The one at George Washington didn't exist. The one at Alabama, the other major programs did not exist. The only other one that was really functioning was the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And Peter DeForest was running that. I had heard of him, but I'd also heard of Ralph just through the grapevine, yeah.
And I assume you'd heard of the Michigan State Criminal Justice Program as well.
Yeah, I hadn't heard much about it. I didn't know much about it. I heard that the forensic science program was in it, and I thought that was curious at the time, that it wasn't in a science department. So I knew none of the history until I really got here and delved into it and talked more to Ralph.
So I gather you had no problem accepting the job when you were offered it.
Well, it's funny. I interviewed here for... I came out by myself. Maggie didn't come because she knew the university. There was no need for her to see it. And I came out here and interviewed the whole day. And then I remember going to the labs, which were in the the fourth floor of Olds.
Yes.
Gee. And I looked at those things and I said, my God, there's nothing in here. There's only a couple of microscopes. And where's all the equipment that I need to do forensic science with? After all, I was in a chemistry department back at Metro. And he was telling me, well, we haven't got much stuff. And he showed me the storerooms, these two storerooms that were just chock-a-block with all sorts of papers and stuff. And I'm thinking, boy, I got to get some, if I ever came here, I got to get some money. And then he showed me the chemistry building. And then he had to run off to a meeting or something for a little while. And I remember sitting right outside the chemistry building and thinking through the whole thing. Is this something I really want to embark on? And really want to do. And I was really excited about Michigan State because it has such a great name. It was April 3rd when I interviewed, and the place was just gorgeous. It had just sprung around here, and everything was starting to be in bloom, and the students were out, and it was warm, and it was just a really exciting place to be. And so I really thought about it for quite some time. But I made up my mind when I went back to Denver that I would probably take this job if it were offered. The one sort of fly in the ointment at the time was that Ralph was going to be starting his consulting year.
Correct.
And so there was no position available at that time. What they were offering was a one-year temporary position and then renewable, if you will, after Ralph retired to a permanent position. Well, I was leaving, and they didn't have tenure at Metropolitan State College. They had something called, I don't know, a probationary status and then a permanent status, and after 3 years you go into permanent status, which is tantamount to tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to leave a position where I was going to be tenured for one that was uncertain. And so when Gwen Andrew, who was the dean at the time,
right,
called me and offered me the position, I said, it wasn't Gwen, it was Bob Trojanowicz called. I had interviewed with George Felkins. He was the director of the school when I interviewed.
That's right.
But he left to go to Long Beach. And Bob Trojanowicz was sort of sitting in then and then ultimately took over. And he called and asked me about the job. And I said, well, I'm very interested in the job, but I don't want to take it on a temporary position because I'm giving up a permanent position here. And then he talked to Gwen Andrew, and she said, okay, well, make it a tenure track position. And then I took it. And I remember being in my kitchen in Denver. My mother was visiting, and I said, yeah, I'll take the position. And so I really liked the whole position. It was just, of course, the university politics that were the only thing that really stood in the way. So then, yeah, I accepted the position and never regretted a day of it, actually.
So after you came here, what was it like to get started? And
well, I had Ralph here, of course, for a year. And he helped me go through all the storerooms and stuff in Olds to see what we had. And he introduced me to everybody. I remember the very first day I was there, he took me over to the Union, to the hallowed table at the Union.
Yes.
With Lou Radelet, and I yourself was there, and I can't remember the other. Byron might have been there, the dean of the natural science at the time, I think, was there, and Bob Scott came along,
right.
I can't remember who else was even there, but it was this hallowed ground which I went to occasionally afterwards a few times too, and I remember that everybody was really very supportive. Trojanowicz, and I met several times, and I told him about the situation, what I thought it needed. He said he wanted an assessment of what the forensic science program really needed to take off after Ralph retired, and I told him what I thought. We needed some equipment and the like, but I basically just mined Ralph for as much information as I could get about the program, and I learned about the history. It wasn't hard to mine Ralph. All you need is a a quiet place, and so we spent that first year really talking a lot about the history of this program and his history and his involvement in forensic science and his passions about forensic science, and to get a sort of a feel for the program and the students. I met the students, and I met my first grad assistant, Toby Wolson, who is a DNA analyst with a Miami Crime Laboratory and has been for going on 20 years. And he was my first grad assistant, and he was an entomology major and kind of floundering around, really didn't know what he wanted to do. And then he and I got together, and we started putting together classes and the like. Toby and I still are in contact, so he remembered going to undergraduate school and meeting Ralph and taking a class or two from Ralph also. So that first year was just sort of settling in and learning about the university, about Michigan State, and trying to get to know people who could help in building the program.
And then how did you develop after when you took over?
Well, of course, when Ralph retired, you know, he never really retired. He just, he still had his office or an office, and he still was there regularly, and we were in contact regularly, and that was true right up until the time he died. We stayed in regular contact, and he'd come in and visit, and I'd call him and say, look, we're thinking about doing this, and the school's going to do this, and what do you think? And we would go to academy meetings occasionally together, so I never lost touch with him the whole time he was around, but my job, as I saw it, was to try to just build up the program. So I started this Introduction to Forensic Science class just to advertise the program. And the first year it had 80 people in it, and which was a large class at that time. I should have known, because this last fall I taught it in this building.
Right, you did.
And there were 402 students registered for the class. Actually, we turned away 100 students. And so this next fall they're offering it over in Anthony Hall, where there's 536 students. So that course was really the first thing I did, and we still occasionally get a student out of there every once in a while to get into the forensic science program. The other major thing that happened that first year was that we had lab up in the fourth floor of Olds, and then the floor caved in. A piece of the floor broke. Some student stepped on the floor, and it just
went through.
Yeah, and so I immediately had a discussion with Bob Trojanowicz about it, and he got Gwen Andrew, the dean, involved. And then I learned about something called the Space Committee here, which is run by the provost office, and is sort of this it's like God, you know. Space, of course, is critical here, and they don't leave those decisions to anybody below the provost. So Gwen went and talked to the provost. She came and actually saw the lab. She said, we have to get out of here. And she ended up doing some horse trading with the dean of the College of Natural Science, and we ended up moving over to McDonald Hall, the dorm, in the basement. They had some labs there. And so we got into a lab over there and set up shop for, and we ended up being there for 3 or 4 years. And at the same time, or during that time, I started to meet Gil Skinner, who was at that time the internship coordinator for the School of Criminal Justice. He had two other people working for him, Debbie Cheesebro and Bob Schultz, I still know Debbie. Debbie is the assistant director of, she's assistant chief of police in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan. Gil is still in Lansing and has a private consulting company. And Gil put me in touch with people who had money. At that time, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration was still operating, although President Carter ultimately axed it. And when he did, there was leftover research money, and I got to meet the guy who was in charge of all that, Chuck Davoli. I had formed an external advisory committee that Ralph was on, and I had Chuck Davoli on it, I had Gil on it, I had a police chief, a prosecutor, a medical examiner, a lot of people on that committee who could be influential. And Davoli, I gave them my sort of vision for the program, and Chuck Davoli said he had some money that he would invest in it. And so he gave me $125,000, which had to be matched, 10% matched by the university. And that got us started. We started getting some equipment and stuff, and he followed that up with some more money. And since then, I've been able to get money from instrument companies. And now we have, of course, have the technology fund that the university gets every year, and we get equipment out of that. And so we've grown now to we are the best equipped forensic science program in the country. We have $500,000 worth of our own equipment. And nobody else owns it. We share some with chemistry, but we don't own most of it. And so the program has morphed a couple of times since Ralph was running it. But it was the premier program in the country when he had it, and it's still a premier program in the country. So nothing has changed in that regard anyway. So those first couple of years were spent in trying to get infrastructure for the program and get people to start believing in it. We started a very vigorous internship program with the state police here, and also tried to send students outside. And the head of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, Barry Fisher, was the first lab director to take an intern outside the state of Michigan. And Barry was well known, as he still is, and that gave the program some credibility that it didn't have, because an out-of-state lab director would actually take an intern. Could we pause for 1 second?
Sure.
My wife just called me.
Okay, we stopped for a second. Now we're back.
Okay. So those first 3 years were designed to sort of give the program some outside exposure, and Ralph had already developed a good relationship with the state police, and so we had that going. He knew all the people from the state police and introduced me to everybody there, and that was a big help. So he introduced me to just about everybody on this campus at one point or another that could have anything to do with forensic science those first couple of years. And that he was really helpful in that regard in getting me known on the campus.
How would you assess Ralph's contributions to the university?
Well, I think he had a number of them including the forensic science program, of course, but beyond that. In forensic science, Ralph was a pioneer. I mean, he was one of the pioneers in forensic science, one of the pioneers, one of the founding members of the academy, and of course, so he had all of that. But he was one of the very few people in this country that was really doing meaningful research in forensic science at the time, in the areas of gunshots and bullets, and especially in alcohol. I mean, that's what he was really known for. So I think one of Ralph's major contributions during his years here was to get this university known as a place where forensic science research is going on, science education, actual research. And of course, he had so many students that got into crime laboratories here and elsewhere that was another contribution. So, I think really when you look back and you say, well, what is the legacy? This is a land-grant university. This is the land-grant university. Forensic science is the quintessential multidisciplinary service program. When I think of programs that are appropriate for a land-grant university, this one is really right at the top of the list. And Ralph put it on the map. And so I think in the forensic science field, this was the major thing that he did. He put forensic science academically on the map. He gave it some research credibility, especially out in the Midwest where nothing was being done in forensic science. The East Coast had John Jay College, as I said, and then George Washington and New Haven were starting up. But out here, there was nothing. And Ralph really made this a center for the forensic sciences. Another thing that I think was a major and perhaps overlooked contribution that you don't realize until you spend some time here and learn about Ralph's contributions. He was interested in far more than forensic science, than the science of forensic science. He was interested in forensic science and the law and how forensic science interacted with the legal system and how it, you know, the public policy side of forensic sciences and their value beyond just the laboratory and the crime scene. That got me interested in that. I had never even thought of that. And I've been very interested in that ever since, and I owe that all to Ralph's sort of viewpoint that he took about forensic science. You have to look beyond the courtroom at this field. And then, of course, he had his overseas adventures, shall we say, he was known everywhere, all over the world. This university makes noise about its international studies and its international impact now. You know, this is not something that just came up overnight. Ralph was one of a handful of pioneers in this place to take Michigan State overseas, and not just forensic science, the entire university mm-hmm. went with Ralph when he went overseas. And a lot of the early groundwork of Michigan State as a university, not just a forensic science program, overseas, I think was due to Ralph's influence over there. So I think his contributions, although terrific in forensic science, go way, way beyond that. And of course, he was a Renaissance man. There was nothing he didn't know something about.
That's true.
And
Or wanted to talk about.
And if you had some time and were willing to listen, the man was a fountain of information about a lot of different things. So I constantly learned from him and about a lot of things even outside of forensic science. Some things I didn't even care about, or, you know, I go and ask him what time it is, and I learned how the watch worked. So, I think his impacts were far-ranging on this campus. And he was a contemporary, of course, of Zoltan Ferency, who was a real firebrand on the campus, and he and Ralph were always cooking up stuff together, and that's how I got to know Zoltan. And they really kept the pot boiling here, and that's another thing. I think there's a need for people like that. And I've noticed through the mid-80s and 90s that the university lacks the Lash LaRose and the Ralph Turners and the Zoltan Ferencies and people like that who really keep the pot stirring in this place, who are willing to stand up to the president and challenge them and the Board of Trustees and challenge them. Michigan State has suffered from a lack of that, I think, in recent years. And I think you can see that today in the fact that all of the major decisions being made about this university are being made behind closed doors. And the faculty is, you know, they had this big Senate meeting. They were invited in
there
at the last minute to scream and yell and provide some input. But the medical school move and the reorganization of the colleges are done deals. And they were done deals, you know, before, and there may be some tinkering, but they are financially done deals. I think 20 years ago, the president not only wouldn't have gotten away with that, they wouldn't even tried.
Right.
So I think it's people like Ralph who have a history here, who had a history here, who knew Hannah, who worked with Hannah.
That's right.
Those are the people that say, no, you can't do it this way. You gotta look at this viewpoint or this viewpoint. And I think we are sorely lacking for people like that these days. And they're missed mostly by the people who were here when Ralph and those people were here and knew. Could see what the impact was of people like this.
How would you describe Ralph's contribution to the profession?
Well, there's the obvious stuff. He was the first secretary of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, one of the founders of the American Academy. And after he died, I went to the Academy board and tried to get them to give him the Distinguished Service Award for the Academy. And they didn't do it, and I was upset with them at the time. I'm still a little pissed off, and it's like 15 years. The criminalistic section gave him the Paul Kirk Award, which
right.
is the highest award that this section can get, which, by the way, I won this year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank
That's
you.
Wonderful.
They gave him that award, and I accepted it for him because the meeting was way the heck out west, and Arnella couldn't make it. It was very touching, and there was a lot of people there who remembered Ralph. But I still think the Academy owed him the Distinguished Service Award. And the excuses they got were there were a lot of pioneers in the Academy. Yeah, but there's only one Ralph Turner, you know. There was only one Ralph. And so that's the obvious contribution, was he helped found the Academy. and was very active in it all through his career, in committees and in papers and in and just everything that he could do. Of course, his contributions, he had substantive contributions to the Academy too. Some of his work, his research presented at the Academy. His organizational skills with other universities and getting them involved, getting education really on the focus of the Academy, because it never was very much when it was founded. And it was only through people like Ralph and a few others that education got recognized as being important. Now, of course, the Academy has gotten to the point where it's partnering with the National Institute of Justice to accredit forensic science programs. So we did a pilot. I'm on the accreditation committee, and we did a pilot accreditation last November, and MSU was one of two graduate programs that stood up for accreditation and got it. So this is the sort of the end point of the legacy of Ralph's contributions to education. So I think his contributions to the Academy were not only in organizational skills and development of the Academy and networking, but also in his research and his scholarly work, but making forensic science education a part of the Academy was also one of his important contributions there.
How would you describe Ralph as an individual?
Where do I start?
Anywhere you want.
Yeah, outgoing, certainly. Anybody who meets him would describe him that. Extremely smart. Ralph, when you look back, he had this country charm about him that belied... a really smart guy, a really intelligent, thoughtful, scholarly person. He wrote extremely well, you know, reading some of his book chapters and his articles and stuff. He had a great command of the English language, which I have no doubt was developed from his wide interests in everything and everybody. So he was, at the very top of it, he was very, very smart, a lot smarter than I think some people give him credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And you really had to sit down and talk to him and really listen to him and read his stuff to understand that. His speaking skills were very folksy and very sort of quaint, and that gives people the idea that, you know, you're dealing with some sort of hick, you know. In the same sense that some people from the South are treated that way by people from the North.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, of course, he had to overcome serious speech impediments.
That's correct.
And, you know, there was no hint of that when I knew him. He had that cigar in his mouth, which was part of his, you know, therapy, but
right.
There was no hint of any speech problems when I met
right.
him. So he had significant handicaps to overcome, which he did. So first and foremost in my mind was the fact that this man deserved to be where he got. He had a great reputation and deserved every single bit of it. Then, of course, the next thing that comes to mind, Ralph, is his wide-ranging curiosity about things and his imagination about things. He was not a surface kind of person. If something interested him, he dove in with both feet until he learned everything about it. That was his style. Some people, you know, they dabble here and dabble there. They get to be a mile wide and an inch deep. Ralph was a mile wide and a mile deep.
That's right.
If he got interested in something, he learned everything there was about it. He knew more about me and my family and my history than anybody does because he asked.
Yeah.
He was never afraid to ask anybody questions. And so I think that abiding curiosity and imagination, I think it goes hand in hand with his intelligence, were the most outstanding characteristics that I think of when I think of Ralph. The other side of another facet of that, on a more personal side, was his human nature. I mean, he was a very kind person, a little blustery, but but underneath it, a very kind person. He's one of these people that I would say does not suffer fools lightly. He had
yes.
very little patience for idiots and people who are acting stupid and foolishness, but he never treated people to their face like that. I never heard him dress down anybody. I mean, to me, he would sputter about so-and-so and what an idiot he was and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But he would never go to that person and demean them. He was a class act, I think, in that regard. So although he didn't have much tolerance for people who were foolish, he certainly didn't go out of his way to make them feel badly about it. There were times when I wished he would, but he left that for other people. But I think those are the things that I think about when I think of Ralph.
Okay, well, this is a good point to flip the tape.
Okay.
So
I'll see if that measures his problem.
Yeah, go right ahead.